Maybe a good exercise moving forward when I don't like, or when neither of us like a movie, is could David Tennant have saved this?
Is it fate or just a date? Bet it's a movie Chelsea or hate. Mads is here to make her watch it. Either way, grab your popcorn, stay in for the evening. You know what it's time for, Love at First Screening.
Hello, and welcome back to Love at First Screening, the show where usually my friend, co-host, and rom-com enthusiast Madison...
That's me!
...introduces me, Chelsea, the resident genre skeptic to all the cliche...
Feel-good.
...questionable.
Romantic.
Sometimes humorous.
Definitely hilarious.
Films I've never wanted to watch. This week, however... I'm back in the driver's seat because I love to be in control. And it's just the truth, Madison. I am a bit of a control freak and I like to be the one piloting us towards destruction.
Do you think it's because you're an Aries?
I don't know. Astrology is not my strong suit. I don't understand anything. And most of the time when people have, like, a post where they're like, the signs as whatever, I, like, never understand why Aries is what they've said because I don't feel like I fit most glaringly obvious Aries stereotypes. I'm not saying that I don't fit any of them. It's just, like, I feel like the top three are not necessarily... true about me, or they're... If I do possess those traits, they're not... the top three traits of Chelsea. So,
you know, I feel like you're the type of person who would identify more with their moon sign. What's your what sign is your moon in, Chelsea?
I don't know, Madison.
Don't worry, after we get off this, we'll figure it out. I'll send it to Marissa. She'll put you on blast. She'll make your own little Chelsea zodiac mood board.
Okay, great. Great. Speaking of being in control, Madison, we suffered a great loss this week, you and I.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll pour one out for our homie, Serendipity. The lost episode.
It'll be our Atlantis.
It really will be. We'll have that gangly guy in glasses who looks kind of hot, and then that other chick who looks really hot. And basically, it'll be our explanation of bisexuality for future generations, is that lost episode.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Just a reminder to people to read the fine print, I guess? FAQs? I don't know. We don't know what we're doing most of the time, so...
Well, I don't know how to read, so...
No. Well, I mean, why would you? You only spent how many years as an English major?
3.5, bitches. That's right. I graduated a semester early to make sure that no one figured out I couldn't read. We will pour one out for our serendipitous homie who is lost to the internet ether. And we'll do what John Cusack would have wanted us to do, which is just keep chugging along.
That being said, this week we watched the 2011 film The Decoy Bride, starring Kelly MacDonald and none other than David Tennant.
Oh, I love him so much. And there were moments in this movie where I was like, is this going to challenge my love for him? And ultimately, the answer was no. My love was not challenged. In fact, in some ways, it was more reinforced just by the joy of seeing him wear that horrible feathered jacket. Was that feathers? It looked like feathers.
I thought it was fur, but you know what? Either way, it is a fashion choice. I thought it was fur, but be it fur or feathers, let's give those who did not watch this film the rundown. The world cares most for Starlet Laura Tyler. Laura Tyler is getting married to novelist James Arbour. And Laura Tyler, while being probably the most famous woman in the world, wants a private ceremony just between the two of them. The media is a frenzy. Everyone wants a photo of Laura Tyler's wedding. And the paparazzi, Marco, the guy, he inevitably, at the beginning of the movie, gets a photo. And Laura Tyler declares, "When I do get married, you won't even know what continent I'm on." And thus begins the decoy bride. But now, let's forget about the famous people. We're on a tiny rock in Scotland, the Isle of Hague, where we meet our leading lady, Katie Nigai, who has returned home, tail somewhat between her legs after yet another failed relationship. She's just in time to watch her ex-boyfriend get married, the last eligible bachelor on this very small and very sparsely populated isle. And her mother owns the bed and breakfast. Her mother, who is terminally ill and just wants to leave, just wants to make enough money to see the world, doesn't care to be here. Katie, who has left and come back, it would seem, several times. And guess who decides they're gonna have their wedding on this tiny little Scottish island? That would be none other than Laura Tyler, who, being the wonderfully kind and supportive fiance she is James Arbour's perhaps biggest fan. James Arbour, who wrote a novel called The Ornithologist's Wife, which is the only novel ever written about this island of Hague. And the Hague Book Club gave it, I think, what, 3.5, 4 stars? Thought it picked up around page 600. It is entirely wrong. Everything in the novel about this island is wrong. And so Laura Tyler's team shows up to the island and needs to make it perfect for her, because of course everything James has said about this island is wrong, and so they have to basically construct it from scratch. They are working under the guise that they are a marketing conference. They've rented out the castle in order to have their, in quote-unquote, conference, but instead it's going to be the wedding. James and Laura arrive on the island. James doesn't even know where they are until Laura says something. And then, while in the midst of them getting ready, Laura, on a run the morning of her wedding, sees Marco, the photographer that got the photo of her last attempted wedding, and she freaks out. She knows that they've found her. It's only a matter of time before other paparazzi show up, and her one and only wish is for this wedding to be a secret, private affair, just her, James, and I guess in this case, no one other than their respective, like, publicity teams, because it's too risky to have anyone else there. It's just gonna be them. So she runs off. James is getting ready, and Laura's agent, Steve, realizes that she's gone, and they are out looking for her, but they can't let James know. So he asks, for the first time in this movie, "Where's that horrible girl?" Meaning none other than our leading lady, Katie. He convinces Katie, with a ridiculous amount of money, to put on Laura's wedding dress, go to the chapel with James, and pretend to be the bride in order to fake out the paparazzi so they can have the real wedding later. James can't know about this because he might run away. He might look for Laura, creating more of attention. He needs to believe this is the real wedding, and he does. The paparazzi don't get their photos. James and Katie are whisked back to the castle to await Laura's arrival whenever she's found. And it is while they are locked in the tower that they realize that they both signed their real names on the register, which is the legal portion of the marriage. And so Katie and James unwittingly married each other earlier that day. Then Katie's mom has sold out the wedding to the paparazzi. The island is now swarming with press and media. And James is like, "I need to go find Laura." So he climbs out a castle window, and Katie climbs after him. She's not supposed to get the bottom of the dress wet, but she completely falls in the moat and almost drowns. James has to rescue her. They go off. They seem to be connecting. They're both kind of angry and annoyed with each other. He, because the woman he loves is out somewhere on this island, possibly stepping on hedgehogs, because there are no wolves, to be honest. And the only danger is she might step on a hedgehog. Meanwhile, Laura has infiltrated the paparazzi. She has used candle wax and makeup and cotton to make a fake face for herself, disguising herself as an old woman to try and get back into the castle. She's denied entrance, of course, and now she's got her sights set on the woman that sold out her wedding, aka Katie's mother. Meanwhile, James and Katie are seemingly burying the hatchet. They've calmed down a bit. They're laughing, but now it's known that Katie's mother has sold out the wedding, and James takes off. Katie goes to follow him because they kind of need to dissolve this marriage that neither of them wanted. She does eventually find him. They find the town priest. They annul the marriage, and so that James and Laura can marry each other. Cut to a year later. Laura, who said she was going to retire, isn't retired. And James has come out with a much shorter and better book as his sophomore novel, which the Hague Book Club gave a 7 out of 10. Pretty generous. And Katie has written a guidebook to Hague, and she had traveled with her mother. Her mother has since passed, and she's off again when who does she see as she's getting onto the ferry but James, who has come back for some reason, calls after her. They get on the radio. She learns that the book is dedicated to her, as the dedication page reads, "To my wife, sometimes a chapter can be a book." Turns out the only woman he ever married was Katie. He and Laura just let the press believe that they were married to kind of keep them off their backs. And he came back for her because there was just something about her. And so she has her ex-boyfriend, who runs the ferry boat, turn around, go back to the island, and they share a kiss. And thus ends the movie, The Decoy Bride.
Excellent summary. I do want it noted that I spent probably 2/3 of this film going, God, I know her. How the fuck do I know that actress? And refusing to look it up because I didn't want to spoil anything. Like, I didn't want to know anything about it. I was like, you know what? I'll just look it up afterwards. About 2/3 of the way through, I was like, oh, was she the one who married Colin Firth in Nanny McPhee, the movie I probably watched over a dozen times as a child? The answer is yes, that is her.
You want to know what she actually might best be known for, Madison? She is the voice of Merida.
Is she really?
In Disney's Brave. Yes, she is.
Wow. Well, I guess I just aged myself with my understanding of her. And that does lead me to one comment that I have written in the notes on my phone that I was taking, which was, I would watch this movie just to hear her speak for 2 hours.
The Scottish accent is truly wonderful. And David Tennant is Scottish, but does not speak with a Scottish accent in this film. He is British.
That's actually the second note underneath that, which is, why can't we have David Tennant's real accent? Why can't we ever have David Tennant be Scottish? I just want it. I don't think I'm asking for too much, but maybe I am.
Madison, before we get too far, I think to answer the question we always answer, which is, did you like this movie? I think you did. I think you did enjoy this movie quite a bit.
I did. This movie had a great cast. It was funny. We'll get more into that. And it just, it gives you the rom-com feels. There were moments in it where I was like, oh my God, he's such a dick. I don't know how he'll come back from this, you know, moment. But then I just remember he's David Tennant and it's fine. And I also really loved that I feel like it got to the heart of white men writing, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, I do sometimes wonder, because every time I rewatch this movie, I just think, yeah, he's not great. Like, he's not super nice to her. So part of me does wonder if my willingness to forgive him is because he's David Tennant and, like, watching him be, like, kind later on and, like, soft is, I just forgive him. But if this had been a different actor, maybe I would have not enjoyed the movie as much. I don't know. Maybe we can analyze that later over how much of this is successful because of David Tennant and how much of this is the film and story itself.
As far as plot lines go for these characters to come together in a meaningful way, like, right out the gate, I'm like, this does not pass that vibe check. I mean, it's essentially, Chelsea, we're not even 20 minutes into the recording, but I'm just gonna say this. It's giving hate fuck vibes. And, like, maybe it's too early to bring that phrase into this episode. But it does, because you have these people who are in this situation. They're just, like, constantly insulting one another. And I can't really tell who starts it. No, I can't tell who starts it. He starts it, but you could say that she unwittingly started it, because they meet first in the urinals, the historic urinals, is that, or is public urinals?
It's a public toilet.
He's like, oh, do you live here? And she's like, what the fuck? No, we live in these primitive things called houses. But she doesn't know who he is. It's not like he's saying, hey, I'm this person. And he's carrying around a copy of his own book.
To learn about the island.
Yeah, he's using his, like, his terrible book to figure out, like, oh, how much of this did I fuck up? Like, let me see if I can use my own poorly written whatever as a guidebook. And so he ends up at the public toilet, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to intrude. And then she's like, oh, well, you're probably lost because that book's a piece of shit. Like, that's a terrible book. And so you could say, well, she kind of came out the gate hating on his book. I would do that. If it's a shit book, it's a shit book, especially if you don't know who you're talking to. Like, so really, he came out the gate real strong with being a dick. And then she just gave it right back, which she should. But ultimately, this does not make a pair that you want to root for. But also, it's David Tennant, so, like, how could you not root for him? You know what? We're just going to go ahead and talk about that right now, Chelsea. In terms of casting for this movie, I love that Laura seemed unhinged, which you would be if you were basically hunted like a dog since you were a teenager by men with cameras. She was unhinged. David Tennant just came across as, like, a white man that writes, and that's the only way I can describe it. And so the only way to make him forgivable is to make him David Tennant.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I do have a really strong hunch that most of the reason I enjoy this movie is for Kelly MacDonald and David Tennant. I don't know. I think if you took them out of the story, I think if I read this story, I don't think I would like it at all. I don't know. I just think they have great banter, and I think they have pretty good chemistry, and I think they both individually are really fun to watch as these characters, and the surrounding shenanigans is just, like, a fun backdrop for what's happening. But yeah, I don't know that this romance is particularly compelling outside of my love for the actors portraying the romance. I think, you know, we had a conversation very early on in our podcasting journey in which I asked you, why do you like rom-coms? And you said you like them because they're bad. And this, yeah, I think, is not a great romance, but I love it nonetheless because of the people portraying it. Is that a mark of great actors that they can elevate something that's like not that great? I don't know. It's truly baffling. This is one of those movies that I'm just as confused, I think, by anyone else that I really enjoy this movie.
I just,
because on paper it makes no sense.
I know. I was really shocked that you enjoy this because I know I am a mark for charisma and for just a silly romp where two charismatic people fall through a half-baked story. And that is most rom-coms. A good rom-com is just a couple of charismatic folks just waltzing through a pieced together plot line. And that's enough for me. I'm the type of girl who would rather just eat the cookie dough instead of waiting for the cookies to bake. And I feel like that also summarizes my feelings about movies that I like. But this movie, I mean, it had everything that you want in that sort of raw cookie dough movie, which I did actually eat while watching this, which is why I feel like this is really perfect. The characters aren't compelling. The story was a little wacky, especially the part with Laura and the mom, where Laura's basically like, you can throw the money over the cliff or I'll just push you in your whole ass wheelchair with the money over the cliff. Insane. And then also the way that Laura's storyline plays out, where it kind of gives the sense that she ends up with the paparazzi that's been hounding her this whole time, because he realizes that the reason why he was basically stalking her all the time was because he was in love with her, which it's a no for me, but all right. And then she's like, actually, maybe that's kind of nice. And I'm like, therapy now. I honestly feel also like David Tennant's character, I didn't really care what happened to him plot-wise, just as long as they got together and he was David Tennant. I didn't really care.
Maybe a good exercise moving forward when I don't like, or when neither of us like a movie, is could David Tennant have saved this?
Yes. Oh my God. That should definitely be a new benchmark. And I mean, that's not to say that this movie had good writing when it came to dialogue.
Absolutely.
And I mean, like, Michael Urie's character, just basically all the little scenes with him were so funny. And I really think it's just because he's funny. Like, he played that role so well. The instances the characters ended up in were excellent and really well written. The through line was a thread at best, a little bit frayed on the ends, but it was good.
Yeah, I agree. I think the writing in this movie, in terms of particular interactions, the dialogue is really smart, and I think really complements the characters themselves. Michael Urie, who people will remember as one of the love interests in the Single All the Way movie that we watched a while back, he is Laura Tyler's agent, who is orchestrating this whole thing. He's running the show. He is in charge, but he is tired and frustrated at all of the nonsense that he's having to put up with. He had to remodel a castle because Laura Tyler wanted to walk into a fairy tale, and James Arbour is a bit of a swindler in terms of he wrote a book about Hague without ever having been to Hague and made up literally everything. I mean, he calls James out on it, and it is the kind of the thing I'm like, why are they saving his ass? But he's like, I guess he cares enough about Laura to, like, especially after all of the trauma they've been through in terms of trying to get married. There's been at least a few attempts for them to get married and it just hasn't worked out because of paparazzi. So I think if you are the person, whether you like her personally, like you care about her because you work so closely with her, or alternatively, you are like, I do not want to have to keep like orchestrating weddings. This one is going to work. I'm going to give her everything she wants so that she says I do and we can move forward. Also, importantly, I think importantly, Laura has toyed with the idea of retirement after she gets married, which clearly her agent would not be wanting her to do. So part of me does wonder if this is at least in some part self-serving, because if he keeps her happy and he's done all this for her, maybe she won't retire. And obviously in the end she doesn't. But yeah, so, and I feel like in my synopsis, I did not talk enough about Katie. I mean, so I want to talk about Katie because I think she's great. And I think Kayleigh McDonald does a great job with her. Katie this is a small town story that I can get behind. And it's not just because it's a small town in Europe, but like in terms of the Hallmark small town story, like this gets like pushes those stereotypes away and off one of the Scottish cliffs. You know what I mean? It's rolling down with mm-hmm. the money. Because she wants to leave home, and yet she keeps coming back. And it's not because home is calling her, but home is like this safe place for her to land when things go sideways. She's somebody that has dreams. She is also a writer. She has been writing for a menswear catalog. She's followed some boyfriends off into other places. She's been unlucky in love. One of the lines she says is that one of her ex-boyfriends, I believe, told her that she was just one song, not a whole album. Like, that was the reason that they broke up, which is like, wow, what a fucking terrible thing to say. And of course, that comes back at the end when James dedicates the book to her, the book that is just one chapter. And he says, sometimes a chapter can be a book, and it's dedicated to her, which is really sweet. That, you know, to bring that, you know, full circle. But, yeah, so she, and I think that's one of the reasons that they like butt heads, because he, James, is a person that has found success, but kind of unwarranted success, because he didn't put in the work and the time to actually write a book about Haig. He just decided to base it off there, and it was somewhere no one ever goes. So like, who's gonna fact check him on him other than like the 13 people that live on that island who did? They were like, it's terrible. 3.5, 4 stars.
I want it noted that I did jot down this one note where, and I hope you caught it. You've seen this way more than I have, so you definitely have this scene where the guy is like using the bathroom and they're like, come on, hurry up. And he rips a page from the book to use it as toilet paper. Like, it's hanging on like the toilet paper holder. Yep. And so they're literally wiping their ass with the book.
Yeah. And honestly, it's probably a lot of, it's so big. It's a brick of a book too. But yeah, so he has this unwarranted success, and Katie is a writer, but hasn't had the opportunity, and unclear whether she wants to be a writer of novels or something. She ends up writing the official guidebook to Haig, which is great, at the end of the film. But she knows good writing as somebody who wants to be a writer. She's, you know, aware of what is and is not good writing, and she calls him out on his bullshit, and she's like it's bad. And yeah, when she's having that initial conversation with him, she doesn't realize she's talking to James Arbour. She just sees a man who she assumes is with the marketing conference holding the ornithologist's wife, and she's like, nothing in that book is correct. Like, do not use that. Like, let me show you around. I love the kind of small town charm, and like, everybody wants to be involved. Like, these outsiders are really exciting, which I think is a fun small town thing. I think there are other small town stories where like people are very wary of outsiders, but in this case, you know, they I also love the old ladies in town that are, like, painting rocks, and, like, they're a pound or a pound 50 for the ones with hair. They, like, make these little people out of rocks, and I'm just like, because a marketing conference would definitely want those, like, but, you know, they're shooting their shot where they can, you know, because they are very isolated, and it's exciting to have these new people here. But this is the kind of small town story that I like, because in the end, Katie isn't really asked to choose between away or here. You know, it seems like she can continue to do what she wants. It does appear that she has sold the bed and breakfast. But like, I still think that this will always be her home. But I also think that she, you know, she was able to travel the world with her mom, and she is clearly leaving again. But I feel like a lot of stories force characters to either choose the big city or the small town. And I don't know that this story actually asks somebody to do that. Instead, it seems to let them make their own choices. Her community, they might be a little like, oh, you're back or whatever, but they seem happy enough to have her back when she is there, and excited enough for her when she's off to do whatever she is off to do. And so I really appreciate that about this story. And when it comes to her relationship with James, I think them butting heads, specifically with regards to his terrible book that's completely incorrect, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think you can kind of understand he's very insecure about the fact that he, well, I guess he's really insecure. He hasn't been able to write since he's been with Laura. And it's kind of stated later that the reason is because Laura thinks he's a genius and he knows he's not. But he, like, very correctly has imposter syndrome because he knows that he didn't do the work he should have with that book. So, like, what the hell is he gonna write? And his publisher is hounding him, and, like, he doesn't have it in him because he feels like he can't lie now. Like, he's in too much of the spotlight. And then to have someone like Katie come along and, like, yeah, I mean, she, you know, not for nothing, but she's really not anybody. It's not like she has any connections to anything. She doesn't work for his publisher. She's not famous the way Laura is. And yet it's like this small person having the, like, gall to be like, yeah, you suck and you shouldn't have done that, and, like, this is my home. Like, she's an expert in Haig, and she's like, you didn't do a good job. I feel like that's what makes the needle ever more sharp, because, and maybe that's why it bothers him so much, because, like, her opinion really doesn't matter, but, like, all she's saying is the truth, and he's faced with that, and he's having to come to terms with the fact that he, you know, is not the great writer of our day the way that Laura believes he is.
Yeah, it's almost like you just really need that someone in your life to ground you and sometimes burst your bubble. And that's such a weird concept, because I feel like when we care about each other, we really, really want to build them up. And obviously, in this moment, Katie doesn't care about him in that way. She doesn't even know who he is. And even when she does, she's like, you're kind of a dick, so I'm not gonna give you, you know, the same potential tact that she would with someone who wasn't being an absolute asshole to her. But yeah, I think that from a writer's perspective, she really does provide such a beautiful kindness to him, even if it seems harsh or rude, of bursting his bubble. And that's what makes him a much better writer. And that's why he gets the 7 out of 10 rather than the 3 out of 10 from the Haig Book Club for his next novel. So I liked how it kind of had that little moment in there. I guess I really like that you pointed that out, and I'm waxing on about this because I also just finished rereading Beach Read by Emily Henry. And in her, like, author's note afterwards, she talks about, like, oh, if someone asks me what this book is about, then I tell them this. But if a writer asks me what it's about, I tell them it's about writer's block. And I feel like this movie is also a really good look at how writer's block can be created by people that you think maybe could be muses, but instead put so much pressure on you and make you realize your own mediocrity that it paralyzes you.
Well, and it's speaking of on not necessarily just writer's block, but any kind of creative endeavor, I think the support isn't just being a, like, unwavering cheerleader for someone. I think it also comes with a genuine, like, a push for them to take what they have and make it better. You and I have in the past dabbled in having, like, a writer's group, and I know I've said, like, I'm when it's with your friends, I think they're overly congratulatory on your work, which I think is why it really takes a certain person to be, like, a writing partner, because you do need the person that tells you, like, yeah, it's great, but, like, here's what can be improved, or here's what I'm not understanding. Like, you think you've communicated XYZ, but actually you have not. You haven't even touched on it. Because you're not going to be there to explain yourself, to explain your work to someone once it's out of your hands. And so if you want to get your point across, you really need to make sure that you are presenting it the best way possible. I know V.E. Schwab, who wrote Darker Shades of Magic trilogy and The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, who I know we've talked about on this show. We've talked about V.E. Schwab before. She has said that with respect to Addie, that, like, the act of writing is like having this, like, snow globe, like a glass snow globe in your mind. And that's the idea as it exists in the writer's head. And then you have to take it out, smash it, and put it back together. And that's the act of writing the book. And she said that Addie was what got close, like, the finished product is as close to the snow globe that existed previously as any of her books have been. Because communication's fucking hard. And yeah. Being able to tell a story and, like, capture the way. And I think we don't think about enough that these creative mediums, like, things that exist within a person, like, we have to translate that in order for you, someone on the outside, to understand. And so it does make a lot of sense that what you set out to do and what you create are probably don't match up 100%. I think that you need somebody who's gonna tell you where there's cracks in the glass and, you know, holes and, you know, where's a leak coming out of that snow globe, you know? And yeah. I don't think everybody has that in there. And it's not, I think, because people don't care, you know, but I do think, like, for Laura, I think she is so far gone in terms of being a celebrity that I wonder if she just doesn't have, like, she is great. And so I think she's just decided that James is great and yeah. James knows he's not. So the pressure to be great when you have not previously proven yourself to be so is crippling. And I think that also proves why Laura is not the right partner for him. Because if she were, and this isn't, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, be rude to Laura. I'm not trying to hate on Laura. But if she were the right partner for James, she would be able to push him, whether or not she's a writer. Like, I don't think writers need to be with other writers. I'm just saying that I think he needs a person to support him in the easy and the difficult ways.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And I think that's why, like, in situations where we've swapped work and stuff like that, what I've admired most about your writing is how intricate your world building is, and just how skilled you are at that, because that's something that I feel like I consistently lack. Like, that's why I find realistic fiction the easiest to approach for myself, because it does, you can put a lot more trust that your reader can kind of step into it. And so it's almost lazier for me and less skilled for me to be able to do that. Not saying that realistic fiction isn't, very skilled writing, but it's just very different. And I think that, that's exactly what Katie does for James, is she basically goes like, you wanted to do something, you, if you're stepping into this literary fiction world and you're setting it in a very specific place, you're doing a disservice to your audience and to the place if for you to have half-assed it like this. And I think really what it comes down to, too, is that Laura is an actress. So she's used to filling roles and embodying characters and people. And I think that she found his characters really compelling, because she at one point is like, oh my God, to Katie's mom, you're the ornithologist's wife. You know, you're this take no shit, stubborn kind of woman with a heart of gold, or whatever she said, however she described her. And I think that's ultimately what Laura is clinging to. And I'll be the first one to say, as someone who is not great at world building, if you lack that element, everything is going to eventually fall flat, because your environment interacts with your characters in such an equal measure that, I don't know. I think that you are completely right when you're like, well, Laura thinks she's great because everyone tells her she's great, and she potentially is great, although that one scene at the end, that was rough, buddy, where they're showing her new movie, that was just so bad, and I know it was bad for comedic effect, but I think it is that idea of, like, if you're amazing and everyone tells you you're amazing, then everyone in your circle is amazing, because everything you do is amazing, and everything and one that you touch has to be an equal measure. It's sort of like how I say that I don't have ugly friends. Like, I only have pretty friends. Because if all my friends are pretty, that raises how pretty I am. And so I don't have ugly friends. Would you like me to dig into my notes on this movie?
I suppose I could open my notes too, although... No, I didn't take any.
Oh. Chelsea, let me open up my notes.
I didn't take Decoy any. Bride 2011, and there's a little like bullet point, and I wrote nothing down.
Well, I'll tell you the last thing that I wrote down, which I think is probably the most accurate thing that I wrote down, which is David Tennant kissing women on their foreheads shouldn't be so emotionally devastating, but it always is. Like, if that man is kissing a woman on the forehead, my heart's shattering. You can call it, you know, PTSD from being a teenager who watched Doctor Who. I don't know. But yeah, no, when he kisses her on the forehead, it just makes you want to throw yourself down the stairs of some Scottish castle or walk into a Scandinavian bay, if you want to go with that reference as well. But Chelsea, I think ultimately this movie is just so quintessential rom-com. It's still quite quirky, but it hit all of the quintessential parts that you want. But my favorite scene in this movie actually had very little to do with any of the main characters. And it was the scene with the elderly couple who were both deaf, and they're like, oh, you know, we used to, like, I assume that they've just lost their hearing with old age. They have records and they're like, oh, you're the guy who played the bagpipes on this record. You should sign this. And it was Katie's dad. It was his record. And they confuse him because he's wearing his clothes after his suit got drenched in the moat. But they just like hand him some bagpipes and they know that they can't hear it. But it's just that it's that routine of, you know, listening to music you enjoy and dancing with the one you love, and the way that they looked at each other, like you could tell that they had been looking like that at each other like that for 50 years. And oh, I just like I got teary watching it because it was, I think, the most beautiful display of love that we've seen in any movie that we've watched so far.
It's very, very sweet and touching, that moment with the elderly couple. I also think it's a moment of somewhat realization. Like, this whole day is a realization for James that maybe he doesn't want to marry Laura. Like, maybe he's not. And, you know, he has that whole speech in which, you know, Katie's like, why are you with her? And he basically says, because if Laura Tyler wants you, you kind of have to say yes, because you would be a fool not to. And I just think about how much that kind of inflates the opinion of certain individuals. It's kind of like if the most, okay, all the teen movies in which the artsy girl takes off her glasses and now she's beautiful, and like for some reason the football star wants her in this movie, and everyone is like, why don't you want to be with him? It's like, okay, because like he's, I don't know, not my type. He's in a lot of cases rude and mean to other people, so like just because he's taking an interest in me, I should want to, you know. And yet there's kind of this, I don't want to say mob mentality, but like there is a push for, if certain people have bestowed their approval upon you, that you should want to accept said approval. But I think that that really dilutes the genuine nature of a situation. So I think in one ear people are telling you should want something real, and like, I don't know, the things people say, like, fall in love with your best friend or whatever, like have this foundation of trust and love and respect. But then on the other hand, on the other ear, people are whispering that, like, there are certain people whose opinion matter way more than, like, what is real and what is truthful and what is genuine, and you should want that approval more than anything. And I think that's the situation that James finds himself in. And to a, like, lesser extent, it's a, like, he finds himself in a, like, turned up to 11 version of that. But I do think that Katie also kind of falls within that as well, because she's trying to find her place, she's trying to make her way and everything, and yet people keep telling her like she's not good enough. So she comes home again, you know, and maybe if she kept pushing, which I do think she does in the end. And I don't really think you need a man to tell you that you're not ordinary. But if David Tennant tells you you're not ordinary.
And I think, too, sometimes we just need that reminder, because Chelsea, I'm just such an amazing person that I feel the need to just, like, consistently humble myself and just remind myself, like, Madison. I just basically turn on Orla Gartland's You're Not Special, Babe, and just listen to it on repeat until my ego is in check. But I understand that, you know, other people have the opposite issue, where they need people to raise their confidence. And I do hope that people understand that I am being so sarcastic right now. It's always wonderful to hear from someone that you fancy, admire, whatever, or someone that is socially perceived as, like, you're better, whatever that may be, to look at you and be like, no, you're doing great. Not only are you great, you're exceptional. Just even just the even not just you're exceptional, you're just not ordinary. And I think Katie is the type of person who does not hear that a lot, because I don't think they mean it in any kind of way, but the her community, her mom, they just have a very flippant air about them when it comes to pretty much everything. And I think that kind of lends itself to this idea of, like, a lack of celebration for yourself.
Well, it's kind of like she got herself off the island writing for a menswear catalog. And yeah, maybe it's not the most glamorous job, but it is a writing job. And, like, I don't think people quite understand, because I think when you say I'm a writer, most people are going to jump to a novelist, and the vast majority of writers are not novelists. They are not writing poetry. They are not writing a book that you're going to go down to your local bookshop and pick up. Like, that is not what most writers do. The majority of writers in the world are using their elevated skill of communication to, you know, aid other businesses, companies, brands with everything from, like, advertising to writing the copy that you read in a, you know, instruction manual when you're trying to put together a desk, right? Like, these things are orchestrated, and I think we kind of take them for granted. We don't actually think that, like, a human wrote this. And maybe the only time you actually think that is when they're poorly written, because they've probably been translated 3 times and nobody hired a person to translate. Like, they just put them through Google Translate, and then you have something that where the wording is slightly off, and or they use a word that, like, makes no sense in the context of building a desk. Then you might take notice, because you're like, why is something wrong? But when things are quote unquote ordinary in that way, we take for granted the ease that they bring to our lives, the ways in which they allow us to accomplish the things we want to accomplish. And in Katie's case, that company was trying to sell trousers, and they probably did, because I'm sure she did a great job. And I don't think that that work should be belittled. And yet, when you are someone who is trying to make your way, when you're someone who has a dream, is trying to leave, you want a real writing job. I think for the people that don't have any experience in it, they can look at that like, that's not a real writing job, but, like, it is. And I'm not saying it's Katie's dream, but I just don't think that it should be, you know, I don't think people should turn their nose up at it the way that they do.
I agree. I mean, I think it gets at the heart, too, of, like, why does your job have to be your dream?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But no, I think ultimately, what I found really, really beautiful was it the two older women that she was talking to, when they were like, oh, your dad was a real goer, you know, he was always gonna fly from here, you know, your mom, she stayed here, and she's like, I don't think my mom wanted to stay here. And they're like, no, you're just, you know, you're a mix of both of them. You're going to go and you're going to stay. And I don't know. I thought that was really, really nice. Because in one way, it kind of reinforces that idea of home, that, you know, it's a place where you return back to after journeys. But I don't feel like it was necessarily that. It's more so that it's always going to be there for her if she wants it. It's not an obligation. It's just, it's there if she needs that soft place to land. And I thought that was really beautiful. This movie is really beautiful. You don't expect it to be. It surprises you. but it just has these really deep notes of kindness sort of running through it that didn't get lost in all the juggle of comedy, which was really nice. So this is a well-balanced movie for a 2011 rom-com with a wackadoo plot.
Yeah. You know, this, like many of the movies that I would consider, I don't want to say beloved, I feel like that's too strong a word, but movies that I want to rewatch again and again, I just found it scrolling through your streaming service of choice and decided to watch it because either there was a good, it had a good cast, or the plot sounded either great or ridiculous, and then here we are. Mm-hmm. I'm making other people watch it.
I love it. That's how cults start, Chelsea, and I will join yours any day.
Great.
Yeah, you just go, hey, I like that person. I'll jump into this. Let me bring other people with me. Suddenly, you're all sitting around a campfire wearing the same outfit. I do want it noted that I do think that you did pick a rom-com.
I just really thought I'd mix it up here in season four, you know? When you think I'm going to zig, I zag. And then when you think I'm going to zag, I do zag just to mix you up for the next time I might zig, you know? To borrow from a great writer.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll walk us through if this is a rom-com. First and foremost, do they date?
Well, they don't date in the traditional sense. But to expand upon the idea, do we see these characters, this couple, growing closer together throughout the film and having real emotional moments together that feel significant to the story and their journey?
I would say yes, although it was certainly more drawn out than I expected it to be. Like, they were sort of in that sniping back and forth sort of vibe a lot longer than I thought they would be if we were to expect them to come together. But it also read as like the old couple bickering sort of vibe as it went along. Like, it started out more harsh and then just kind of devolved into this funny back and forth, and then slowly continued to move into something that felt really genuine. And when they are getting the marriage annulled, you can just see the regret or the want between the both of them of like, shit, I know that's crazy, but I don't think that I actually want to leave this person. This person's great. And actually, I'll insert my fix here. You were talking about, you know, I don't think that I would buy into this relationship if it was a book. I think if it was a book, you could change it to where he comes like a week ahead of time. Like, maybe he gets wind that it's going to be on Haig instead of it being like this big surprise with Lara. He can be like, oh shit, we're going to be on Haig. I've never been to Haig, but I can't let Lara know that, and kind of cover his tracks. And he can spend a week there with Katie as his reluctant tour guide of sorts. And then she gets roped into the whole decoy bride aspect of it. I think that that would make the romance a lot more believable than just that single day. Where they spend most of the time griping at each other. But I think that this movie, even with the rushed time frame and everything like that, and maybe again, it's just the cast, but I do root for them. And you can't have feelings, like, you can't have the audience root for them if you don't give them something to root for. And so ultimately I would say yes, they do date, because I was rooting for them, even if it was just David All Tennant.
Right. You can't root against David Tennant.
Okay, here's the fucked up thing. You want to know something horrible? David Tennant was the villain in the TV show Jessica Jones. All right? He was a bad guy. All right? And even then, I was like, damn. I hate to hate him. And he was like a really bad villain. He was a bad motherfucker in that. But I still was just like, oh, but he's David Tennant. You know? Like, that was poor casting. Yeah, I just, like, that just popped up from the deep recesses of my memory. That TV show. But Chelsea, I think the next one is the real slam dunk of Did We Laugh?
Oh, absolutely. The dialogue, the characters. You didn't laugh?
Oh, no, I did laugh. And I have one specific line that I nearly peed myself because it was such a throwaway line and so amazing at the same time. And it was when Katie looks at Michael Urie's character when she basically figures out that she's in for a whole lot more than she originally signed on for. And she's like, you're so full of shit. And he's like, yeah, my last colonic took a week. So good. And there were just so many of those lines, just those throwaway lines that end up just having you piss your pants for how funny they are.
Yeah. The writing's good. The dialogue is good. It's got some great lines in this movie.
Oh, yeah. And also just some really good physical humor as well. It's just sprinkled through this. When that one paparazzo figures out that she's an old lady makeup and she just fucking roundhouse kicks him in the face. Inspired.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that this might be one of the funniest movies that we've seen this season. And that's actually pretty tough because we had Andy Samberg, Palm Springs, for it to go head to head with, and that was a funny fucking movie. So
yeah,
they're pretty neck and neck for me. But Chelsea, is love of all things in the driver's seat? And I actually want to throw this to you specifically because you are the queen of they should not have ended up together.
But it's I'm at war with myself on this one, Madison. I'm at war because, like, on paper, I don't think I would root for these people. But I don't know. There's just something about them. And I want them to interact more. So, you know, they gotta get together. Is romantic love in the driver's seat of this movie? I kind of think it is. And it's a weird one because their romance is one that has developed less than 24 hours, which, as we know, I don't like. But I don't think that they're in love with each other after 24 hours. I think that for each of them, the other represents something that is missing from their life and that they want, that they desire, and that they want to go after. And then we have a break, which I think is a good thing for this movie. Because really, they don't get together until the epilogue, you know? Like, mm-hmm. We jump forward in time several months, if not a year or longer, and that's when they get together. Time has gone by. He's written a whole book, albeit much shorter than the first one. And he's come back to Hague to find her. You know, he clearly has been thinking about her. She's been thinking about him. And so, you know, they're gonna figure it out, I guess, is where you're kind of left, which I appreciate in a movie because and maybe that's why I can get behind this romance, is because I don't feel like they're declaring their undying and unwavering love to each other. I think instead they are allowing themselves to go after what they want and to make moves to have that be reality. And I think I think I admire that in people. I think so much of this world makes you really scared, and you know, it's not easy to say out loud what you want sometimes. And so I think for these characters to not only do that, but to do it in a way that's kind of like, right, like they have to say it in front of other people that, you know, her ex-boyfriend and his wife are on the boat and he's yelling off the pier, you know. It's a much better version of the airport, you know, running in an airport to get somebody before they get on a plane, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it just works better as a boat, or maybe it just works better in this instance. But I do think that, you know, they are each, at least towards the end, they are each propelled by a desire to make changes in their life. And I think it just happens to be, you end with a romance between the two of them. And I do think that each of them played an important part in helping the other person get there. So mm-hmm. I suppose in that respect, I don't know. I feel like you're making me justify this. And usually you're the one like jumping through hoops to tell me something is a rom-com. Yeah, I think it passes.
Well, Chelsea, let me pose you this question. What is love if not just mutual possibility shared between the hearts that wish to share it with each other?
Did James Arbour write that?
Yes, correct. oh my God, what is the horrible line? The like something of longingness or whatever?
Yeah, Lara says that she's make me concave and fill me with caverns of longingness or something.
That sounds like disgustingly kinky.
Yeah.
Yeah, not here to yuck anybody's yum, but I'm yucking that. I think that this is a rom-com. It gets my 3 out of 3 stamp of approval, and I am a notary public, so that is legally binding.
Madison, if you were asked to rate this movie on a scale from 1 to 5 with the fanciful rating system based on a walkability score in real estate, with 1 being stranded in the desert, 2 being a backroads barbecue, 3 a strip mall in suburbia, 4 blocks from a transit stop, and 5 the best coffee in town is right downstairs, where might you rate this film?
I thought about this a lot because I feel like this movie actually has a surprising amount of rewatchability that has to be factored into the score. And usually I feel like if I give something a 3, then it's sort of a 1 and done. Like, it's worth watching, not necessarily worth watching again. So I think I'm gonna have to give this one a generous 4 because I would rewatch it. I enjoyed it the first time. I would look forward to showing it to other people. My caveat with that is that, once again, the reason why it deserves that is because the actors in this movie acted their asses off. They don't have asses now. And that's a sacrifice that they made for me to be able to enjoy this movie. So, in honor of their lost asses, perhaps they are now made concave and filled with caverns of longingness. I don't want to say that necessarily, but it's a 4.
Very generous. I'm going to give this also a 4, but I'm also going to give it another 0.5 for David Tennant and Kelly MacDonald. I think the two of them each added a 0.25 to this film. I don't know. I just love it. I love this film. I can't explain it. I've spent the last hour or so trying to rationalize this to the public, but I really like this movie, and it doesn't make any goddamn sense to me or anyone else, because this is not something I feel like I should like, and yet I do. Maybe that's why I like it even more, because I don't think I should like it, and yet here I am championing it. Madison, I have a better question for you, and that's, what do you think the Hague Book Club would give this movie?
Oh my god. I think they would give it, on our scale or on their scale of 10?
They can, on their scale. We'll let them play by their rules. They do anyway, so.
I think they'd give it a 6. I think they'd be like, I don't know. I can't do a Scottish accent, so I'm instead just going to make them sound like pack-a-day smokers. They'd be like, I think it was a little bit contrived, and I didn't really understand why they ended up together, but, you know, they ended up being a cute couple, and I like that British guy, and that Scottish woman has that good accent, and at least they made Haig look like Haig's supposed to, you know what I'm saying? Unlike that terrible book. That's the voice that I decided to go with to represent a Scottish book club.
They would give that accent a 2.
Yeah, they would. I actually, this is really a joke and a comment for me and like one other person who might listen to this. But if anyone is a fan of Robert Evans, writer, podcaster, journalist, maybe in that order, maybe not, he does a really like ongoing joke of a terrible Boston accent that actually just sounds like disturbingly Australian. And so I feel like that is my Robert Evans Boston accent, is actually just like a pack-a-day northern smoker, vaguely New York-ish, maybe more Boston, Chicago sort of area, as my Scottish accent.
All right.
Don't smoke, kids.
Well, Madison, where might people go to tell us their thoughts on this movie and also others they might want us to watch in the future?
So excited that you asked. They can hit us up on Instagram, slide into our DMs. Look, it takes no confidence to slide into our DMs. And in fact, if you want advice on how to slide into someone else's DMs, we're probably not the people to help you. But if you want to try anyway, you can hit us up on Instagram at Love at First Screening. If you want to send us a more professional, formal note, maybe something longer, you can email it to us, love@firstscreening@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. And more importantly, I want to hear about your bad date stories. So send your bad date stories there before May 7th? 7th. Oh, 7th. I was so close. I'm still learning my numbers, friends. I just keep watching fucking Sesame Street, you know? But after 6, it gets really blurry. My vision starts to go. I think I'm allergic to math. Yeah. Actually, it's, if you'd like to start a telethon in my honor for people with this affliction, please do. My bank routing and account number to send those is 1. Oh shit, I just realized I can't read it out because I can't read the numbers. Anyway, yeah, definitely send us your bad date, funny date, great date in like a wacky way. I keep saying that word. That's my word of the day, apparently, is wacky. But send us your wild date stories. I actually already got one that I plan on sending. Chelsea, did I send you the screen recording of one that I already got?
You did, yes, and I quite enjoyed it.
Perfect, perfect. Well, I'll include that one, and yeah, hit us up. Chelsea, what am I showing you next time?
I feel like that's a question you should be answering.
Well, fine, Chelsea. If you insist on making me take back the reins and everything, is it because I watched both seasons of The Bear this past summer? Maybe. Or whenever it came out. I don't know when it came out. I don't work there. But we're going to watch No Reservations. Catherine Zeta-Jones and that one actress, but when she's little, that one. You know who. We're going to watch No Reservations, and it's going to be great. I think it's Abigail Breslin.
Well, so this is going to be another kitchen, but I'm assuming not as wacky and full of creative choices as the last kitchen one we watched.
Look, Chelsea, I can't have every kitchen movie that I show you include a magic crab and sex fog. It's just a tall order. We can't get Sarah Michelle Gellar every time. She has a busy schedule.
Thank you all, each and every one of you, for coming with us on this deceptively wonderful journey that is The Decoy Bride. We are Love at First Screening. We're here every Wednesday talking about all the rom-coms you love, love to hate, and everything in between. So until next time,
enjoy your stay in Scotland.